From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour will be made at 6:30 tonight when the Labor Day festivities take an unusual turn. The Rochester Labor Day Parade will happen tonight, a Friday night, because local officials want to include some of the marching bands that are in town for this weekend's Drum Corps Associates World Championships. So the Labor Day Parade will get started at East Avenue and Lawrence Street, again 6:30. This hour, we welcome a labor roundtable. We're looking at the state of our unions, and my guests for the hour include Jim Bertolone, the president of the Rochester and Genesee Valley Labor and Federation, and also he is the president of the Rochester Area Postal Workers. Jim, nice to see you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. We've got Erin Young is here. She's the executive director of the Rochester and Genesee Valley Labor Federation. Erin, nice to see you.
It's a pleasure.
Dave Young is here, the president of the Rochester Building and Construction Trades, among other things. That's all you get for the first title, Dave.
That works.
Okay. Tom Gillette is here, the regional director for New York State United Teachers. Tom, nice to see you.
Happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day to all of you here. And for our listeners, if you've got questions or comments, you can join the show by calling toll-free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Gallup has been tracking labor support among the public, and 10 years ago the numbers were a lot closer to an even split than they are today. The labor is enjoying much more public support than even 10 years ago. What's the difference, Jim, between 10 years ago and today?
Well, I think the big difference is what's been going on. The attacks on labor has been going on since Ronald Reagan. But I think the big difference from 10 years ago and today is we now have corporate personhood, which is resulting in a whole lot of bad law to make a whole lot of bad decisions worse. Corporations are people. Money is free speech. Health benefits that are part of a person's wages now – the boss can tell you how to spend them because corporations have religious rights besides free speech. And we're just seeing a whole lot of bad law come out of corporate personhood.
We now see, according to Gallup, about 3-1 Americans approving of the values of public unions. 3-1 approving of the values. It's a little closer to even on the leadership in labor, Jim. And I know you've taken arrows, but that's okay. I mean, I'm assuming you're used to that.
Yes, and that's kind of how the corporate media has portrayed labor over the years, labor bosses, labor thugs, that type of thing. And it's not appropriate, and it certainly isn't the case. All the union leaders I've known over the years, and you get an occasional bad one, but because we're not CEOs, we have to stand for election by our members at regular terms. So a labor leader who's not doing a good job or is bad generally isn't around too long. And one of my most thankful things about the labor movement is all the great people who work so hard for economic justice for people that I've had the pleasure to work with and meet.
We have seen sort of an interesting summer in terms of politics. Typically, July and August are kind of the doldrums, and it's hard for us in the media to get people interested in political races until after Labor Day. But interestingly enough, with just a week after Labor Day is the primary election, and we're seeing a more active campaign on the Democratic side for the governor's primary, with Governor Andrew Cuomo running for re-election. Zephyr Teachout, who is a Fordham Law professor, is running, in her words, as the real progressive candidate in this race. And she was on the program yesterday. She was talking about endorsements in the race. What I want to do is play some of her thoughts about this and then get our panel's thoughts on whether you endorse, how you make that decision, and then, frankly, the panel's view of the current state legislature and governor, and we'll talk about that. So this is Zephyr Teachout on the program yesterday. I had a chance to ask her about the fact that, you know, in some cases, no endorsements are being made at all, whether for her or Andrew Cuomo. As we head toward Labor Day here, you talk about the fact that Democrats in New York State have largely stayed silent about Moreland, et cetera. Well, if you are the progressive candidate who will be on the side of labor, who is concerned that the current leadership is too obsessed with tax cuts for the wealthy, et cetera, why don't we see even more labor backing your candidacy and opposing the governor if you're correct about that?
Well, we've gotten a lot of momentum with labor in the last few weeks. I mean, the Yonkers Firefighters came out, the Public Employees Federation came out. And, just as importantly, I would have loved their endorsement, but the AFL and NYSIT both declined to endorse Governor Andrew Cuomo, and that's a serious rebuke. In terms of the membership, I will tell you, rank-and-file members when they learn about my campaign are supportive. But, you know, let's be honest. Andrew Cuomo has the capacity to really punish some of the unions if they come out against him. So it may be that they are choosing not to take a stand endorsing me because they want to avoid that punishment.
That's Zephyr Teachout. Let me start with Tom Gillette from NYSIT. She said that it is a serious rebuke that NYSIT, AFL-CIO, chose not to endorse at all. A rebuke of the governor. Do you agree with that?
I definitely agree with that, especially in upstate districts, school districts, and locals. Many of our members would love to have had a viable candidate, actually would love to have had Zephyr Teachout emerge as a candidate several months ago, but there's great dissatisfaction with Governor Cuomo, and that pretty much led to the no endorsement position that NYSIT took.
But why not then, if you're that dissatisfied with the governor, endorse his opponent?
Well, I think people are learning about her. She had a great turnout yesterday at the Village Gate for an event here, and they like what she's saying. She suffers from that and is blessed, actually, at the same time with the fact that she's not an experienced politician. So it's been difficult for her to get the word out. And, you know, even union bureaucracies are, in many cases, lumbering beasts, and it takes a while for them to get on board with things.
All right, so we're 11 days from a primary. Do you regret the non-endorsement?
Well, I would love to have had a campaign going on for an alternative to Governor Cuomo for the last year, but we'll see what happens in the primary. I think the primary is likely to be very surprising to the governor and to Democrats who are fully in his camp.
Jim Bertolone, she says it's a rebuke to the governor, and you've got Tom agreeing. Do you agree?
Yes, I think I do. I mean, we've seen Tier 6, and I wrote about and had published articles about this when there was $140 billion in the pension fund that we were 100% funded in one of the best pension plans in the country. Now we're over $170 billion, the cap, and we continue to see too many cases from the governor's office to trickle down economics, billions to business that we've seen since Ronald Reagan that is not lifting people up. He has raised the minimum wage, not high enough. We are seeing some infrastructure, which our building trades need, our states need, businesses need. And there is something to what candidate Teachout says about those who pretend, rely on public projects like the building trades, worried about retributions and not getting the work that their members need to make a living.
All right, so let me just rephrase that in a different way then. Do you fear Andrew Cuomo if you were not to endorse him and he wins the primary? Does Labor fear him?
I think that's one of the reasons for no endorsement in the question you asked Tom and the Working Families Party not going to candidate Teachout. In this corporate personhood, Citizens United atmosphere, the governor has so much money, somewhere between 30 and 40 million. And the non-endorsement, I think, especially if that changes after what happens in the primary, still gives Labor a seat at the table. We are a base constituent, historically, of the Democratic Party. So we will still have a place at the table, as opposed to endorsing a different candidate. It might be a little bit more treacherous for us.
Would you like to see the governor lose on September 9th?
That would be interesting. But again, as someone who's a student of history and a history major, the third parties, outside type candidates, do not have a great history in our country. And if the governor lost, and that would mean a hard right Republican could get into the governor's office, no, I wouldn't like to see that.
Let me ask, we'll go around the table now. Aaron? Your thoughts on the same matter. You've been hearing their comments about the fact that I think that this affirms what Zephyr Teachout is saying, is that unions have to be careful. But what are you hearing from members as the executive director? What are you hearing and what are you thinking about the September 9th primary?
My position puts me on the ground with the rank and file.
Yep.
And hearing what I'm hearing working with all sectors, it is very interesting, this entire situation. But we also have to consider that given that this is a governor's race, we have to not only listen to the voices in our own territory, but we have to listen to the voices in the rest of the state as well. Labor has to be as unified as possible this election season because there's a lot of legislation and a lot of moves going on statewide that's going to put people in different places across the various regions. What I'm hearing on the ground is I'm hearing one thing from the members here, and yes, they are very fearful of their losing their jobs with layoffs, privatization, losing their right to collectively bargain, and so on and so forth. The voices sound somewhat different coming from downstate. I think that one of the things that the governor has done is that he has attempted to pit region against region, saying, okay, well, I'm going to give this and this to this region, but you and region over there aren't going to get anything. Developing a scenario of unification in time for a primary has been challenging because of that. So I'm going to say that what I saw in New York City at the convention when we had representatives from across the state, I think that their thoughts were considered and reviewed very carefully, and I think that this was the best course of action at that time, given the time frame. We mobilize using grassroots. We have a lot of programming that gives education to our members on the issues, and it is a process. And because we are a democracy and because that is what unifies labor and keeps labor strong, that's the process that we have to follow.
Dave Young, the president of the Rochester Building and Construction Trades, Zephyr Teachout has made this point, and others have said the same thing. They try to lump Governor Cuomo close to Rob Astorino, the Republican candidate. Ms. Teachout saying that Governor Cuomo has governed like a Republican, and in her words, that's meant as a pejorative. But in terms of labor's view, is there a strong viewpoint that Governor Cuomo is a better alternative than Rob Astorino?
I would say yes, absolutely. There's always concern. We've seen what's happened even with some moderate governors in the Midwest states where all of a sudden at the last moment, even in lame duck sessions, they bring in right to work, blast it through, and a few other situations like that. So that would be accurate.
All right. So you bring up the term right to work, and that has been – that's a term that for many Americans still relatively new and maybe confusing. And by the way, if you're waiting to join the conversation, please do so and call, and we'll be happy to take your calls. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
More accurately, it should be the right to work for less.
Well, I was going to ask for a definition. I see the characterization there. But how do you – when people ask you what it means, and I'm sure this happens even in rank and file, we'll go back around the table. Dave, what do you say to people when they say, hey, I've heard in Wisconsin, I see the movement in other places, I hear so-and-so talking about it. Right to work, what does it actually mean?
Well, in our industry, as much as any, the right to work usually means a loss of our benefits. Our pensions take a terrible hit. Our health insurance declines, and eventually wages decline, because what right to work does is it defunds the unions. We're not in a position to negotiate properly. We're not in positions to get our message out to people, what's right, what's wrong, what's helpful to the community, et cetera, et cetera. It's I was going to use a quote that I know Jim has, so I'm going to let Jim take that one from Martin Luther King. But it's basically what the right to work does. As it states that a person can be eligible for all the services a union provides to them, all the negotiation, the representation. We need to represent everybody fairly and equally, but they don't have to pay for it.
Jim Bertolone, it's important to point out in this state, we don't have a business community that is pushing for right to work in the same way that we have seen in the Wisconsins and other places.
Yeah.
So as much as it's important to define because it's part of the conversation, mm-hmm. It's not as relevant here.
No, it isn't. But it's also important to understand the historical context. And when Taft-Hartley was passed over Truman's veto in 1947, just like when the Fair Labor Standards Act and the National Labor Relations Act for the rights of workers and a minimum wage and the 8-hour day was passed in the 30s, FDR had to make a bipartisan deal with conservatives. And unfortunately, those conservatives were Southern Democrats. So excluded from these labor laws were agricultural workers, still excluded today, domestics, house servants. And this was in the South, this was mostly African-American men and women. It allowed them to keep Jim Crow in the workplace. It allowed them to be exempt from the minimum wage. Then when we saw Taft-Hartley pass with states' rights having right to work, the old slave states, every single one of them established right-to-work laws, again, to keep Jim Crow in the workplace. The original founders of right-to-work, one is the father of the Koch brothers, who was a founding member of the John Birchers. Some were also officers or heads of the Ku Klux Klan in southern states. This is the origin of right-to-work. We have to remember historically with the Klan, after Africans, Americans, and Jews, unions and union organizers were on the Klan's list as not their favorite people, and this is the history of right to work.
All right. Before we get into more of that, I want to grab a quick call here. Jenna's been listening, and she wanted to weigh in on, well, Andrew Cuomo, money, and more. Go ahead, Jenna.
All cards on the table. I know Evan knows that I had made a presentation to Rob Astorino on education, Common Core, APPR, which I am vehemently against. I consider bullying of our kids and a violation of the Dignity Against All Students Act. But I'm a big supporter of just getting Cuomo out of office in general. And when I heard you say that endorsements were withheld because you're afraid of the amount of money that he has, that really terrifies me. And it terrifies me for one reason. I used to be a sales manager in media, and one of the things that I know for a fact is that New York State United Teachers, when they endorse a candidate, it tends to sway the election tremendously. And for you to withhold an endorsement solely because you're afraid of the amount of money that the current candidate holds in his bank account is disingenuous, not just to the people you represent within your union, but to the students and the people within the state in general. That is a very scary thing. And what it does to me is it solidifies Astorino's comparison of Cuomo to Don Corleone. And if you think of the modern mafia, what Gotti did was solidify them and kind of bring them together to be a more peaceful unit. And what Cuomo is doing is dividing our state, our teachers, our students, and our entire population. So what you've done is really, really scary for this election. Really scary. Really, really scary.
Jenna, thanks for the call. And she's a passionate person.
Let me
go
respond
ahead,
a little bit, Evan.
Please do.
I appreciate the comments. The process that NYSET uses during the endorsement season involves local presidents from all across the state convening at our headquarters in Latham and making a determination, arguing the strengths and weaknesses of various candidates and considering a whole raft of things. That happened August 10th through the 12th of earlier this month, and the NYSET Board of Directors then took that information from that process, which was democratic with a small d, and that was the source of the failure to endorse in that race. I think it's an oversimplification to say that it's because Cuomo has a huge war chest. Probably was a consideration, but there are other things.
Okay. Jim, the same note?
And I also appreciate the caller's comments, but unfortunately, unions are also democratic. And as Tom said, all of the unions that aren't teaching unions, their leadership and electric delegates also were at the state AFL-CIO convention, voting their members and voting their conscience, and that's the result of the vote. Sometimes we don't agree with democracy. I do think there is a remedy, and we're seeing it in this country now to fight the big money. Whether it's, you know, nationwide, our last federal election cycle was in excess of a $6 billion cycle, and this money is free speech. And that's people power, whether it's the fight for $15 an hour. Solidarity is a strategy, but it requires, like we saw in Chicago with the teachers union, where they bonded with the community, where we're not just fighting for the rights of teachers and education, but we see teachers in mass standing with the poor community for the social services and the living wages they need, the wraparound services. That is really the problem in our inner cities, the poverty with education.
I assume everyone on this panel supports campaign finance reform laws in the state, yes or no? Is there anybody who would oppose that? I mean, Jim, you're talking about the influence of big money in
yes.
politics. Okay, campaign finance. So we'll have to see. As Zephyr Teachout again has said, she's in favor of that. Governor Andrew Cuomo had said he was strongly favoring campaign finance reform, and then in this past year essentially ignored that and allowed it to kind of go by the wayside. But we'll see going forward if there is more of an impetus for that. Now, there's a lot of issues we could touch on here as we talk about labor, as we approach Labor Day. If you're just joining us, we have a labor panel with Jim Bertolone, Aaron Young, Dave Young, Tom Gillette here representing local labor and talking about the issues relevant now, current now, as we head for the Labor Day weekend. And tonight is the Labor Day Parade. It's 6:30 tonight. You may not be used to that, but Rochester made a shift when they wanted to make sure that they accommodated the local Drum Corps Associates World Championship. So you're going to see more participation there. The parade gets started at East Avenue and Lawrence Street at 6:30 tonight. The local business community, I want to kind of shift the conversation because about 6 weeks ago we had Brian Sampson, we had a number of local superintendents from an organization called Let New York Work. That's a branch of Unshackle Upstate, and they have their provisions on what they would like to see change. And there were some callers who had complained on that day, and I understood why. They said, look, you've got to get labor's perspective. And I made a promise. I said, all I wanted to do during that conversation was hear what Let New York Work was about. Then I wanted to bring labor to the discussion. And then what I want to do on a future show is bring everybody together. And we may not all agree, but we can talk about what the issues are. On that day, when they talked about Let New York Work, Brian Sampson and his colleagues stressed the point that they're not looking to be Wisconsin, that it's not right to work, and that they're looking for fairness. And in their words, the fairness comes when there is a balance. Public employees helping them out, but versus what taxpayers can afford to do, and that they said, you know, look, 8, 9, 10% of people are public employees, and that they can't really, force unnecessary burdens on taxpayers. That there should be a willingness to balance. That was one of the points we heard there, but not to the point of right to work, not gutting unions, not taking away union membership, etc. Well, I see a lot of head shaking around here. Let me start with Aaron. Go ahead. What do you think?
Well, as far as that particular group is concerned, I think that the way that the initial campaign was launched to the community was called the New Era. And what it was essentially was we need to alleviate some of the burden on small businesses, people making under $50,000 a year. It sounded like such a positive thing to do for our community. However, where things tend to go wrong, in my opinion, is when we're talking about how to accomplish these tasks. Everybody has a difficult task to work, A, with the budget that they have. I'm talking about local municipalities. But without laying off hundreds, sometimes thousands of workers that really make the community a nice place to live. Not to mention the fact that as far as being a burden on taxpayers, I feel that it's more of a burden when you have more and more people in the community that have to rely on subsidies in order to make ends meet. What labor is trying to do is we're taking a look at this whole initiative of theirs and saying, you know, they want to accomplish these things by a lot of people may hear, you know, unfunded mandates or mandate relief, and we need to help taxpayers out. Well, you know, I don't believe that helping people by taking away work protections, safety protections, by pay freezes, by going after their pensions, I don't see how that improves the economy here. And I don't see at the very end how that really creates any type of relief for taxpayers when they're just going to go right into having to subsidize their incomes. I'm not seeing how that would work. So that's pretty much my perspective.
Yeah, the bullet points on Let New York Work are reforming the pension system, redefining compulsory arbitration, when contracts expire, freeze the step increases, reduce the cost of construction and private public projects, not, as we've heard in the past, scrapping WICs and scaffold, but by reforming WICs law and increasing the threshold to a uniform $10 million across the state, establishing minimum health insurance contributions level for employees and retirees, and no new mandates. Again, we're going to spend an entire hour at the table with everybody involved on a different day, but you heard some of Aaron's concerns. Dave, jump in there and go ahead.
Sure. I'll go directly to the construction industry. I know Jim's very well versed on other areas. Raising the limit on the WICs law,
yes.
That might be fine for New York City. I think it's even high there, but very few projects reach $10 million here. The WICs law has been proven to save money. It's a sunshine law. It's transparency. It's to avoid corruption. Perhaps there's no more corruption left in this world, but that would surprise me. The scaffold law, you know, construction is one of the most dangerous industries in the nation. Thousands of people are injured or die each year from gravity-related injuries. The insurance companies claim it costs money, yet they won't show any. They will not offer any evidence of what it costs or doesn't cost.
Well, Dave, every time scaffold comes up, those who oppose it tell me that this state is too extreme and that always blaming the employer for an employee's injury and that not even being able to examine whether an employee could have been at fault.
That's not how the law is written. Period. It's a nice sound bite, but that's not how the law is written. That's not how the law is supposed to be enforced. All it does basically is it states that the employer is responsible for providing the safety equipment necessary for a worker working in precarious situations, any elevated situations, period.
And if that is the law, if that's all the law says, that shouldn't be controversial.
Correct. It also has some third-party liabilities involved, which the developers don't like, which means they have to search out and find quality construction contractors, people who actually do these, meet these requirements, which means they don't always get the absolute cheapest price. But it gets to the point where at what cost is a person's life or health or safety worth?
And Jim and Tom, before we take the shortest break in radio and then get to phone calls that are starting to pile up, you know, in the Let New York Work agenda, they're talking about making the pension system affordable across the country. Her pensions, and it's different public, private. It's different in city and state governments, et cetera. But Jim, briefly, when it comes to pensions, what's wrong with what Let New York Work say about the pension system?
Well, I think it's if you look when they started this agenda, the New York State pension was $140 billion. It now exceeds $170 billion. Controller Donopoli's done an excellent job. Our pensions are 100% funded. I believe at this point it's a non-issue. I do have some issues with the pension system. Some of the same people who are always crying about unfunded mandates are running cities, counties, school systems, and states at six-figure salaries and appointing people to six-figure jobs and putting them in the pension system, non-civil servants. That, I think, needs to be looked at. Other issues, I want to add to what Dave said. He started to mention it on the scaffold law. As a member of the New York State AFL-CIO Executive Council, prior to workers' comp reform, we finally got them to open up the books. And they kept raising employers' workers' comp rates 2 years running. And when we got the books open, we found out that the insurance providers' costs had actually gone down. Their medical bills had gone down, and their lost time had gone down. That's, as a starting point, we have a bill in the Assembly. We want to see the books to see that the insurance companies and the banks, some who own insurance, are not ripping off everybody. We hear a lot of anecdotal evidence from Unshackle Upstate. Show me that this is costing more money and that this is not another thing where we have the private sector coming in and making a pile of money off of a state law.
You're saying, let's see the books.
Let's see the books.
There's an open invitation, and if Brian Sampson is listening, All right. We'll talk about it on a future day.
If I might add, when they did that audit on the compensation insurance, the companies had to write out some huge checks going back to the employers and the contractors for the money they'd overcharged them.
Our phones are flooded. We did have a listener who had called and was interested in the question on what Tom Gillette would say about Lovely Warren's support for charter schools. I'm curious to know, as the leader of NYSET, regional director of NYSET, thoughts on charter schools in the city. And again, a lot of these topics feel like hour-long discussions that we're sort of condensing, but that's sort of the nature of Labor Day discussion. So, Tom, on charter schools.
Sure. It would be wonderful. And as an educator, I taught for decades in the city and loved it. If it was charter schools that would solve the city's problems or some other magic bullet to go through there, I think it would be wonderful. The data doesn't support that. Just like there are good public schools in Rochester, there are good charter schools. There are some that are failing miserably, just like there are city schools here and in other cities that aren't doing well. And I think basically the biggest problem is that charter schools tend to skim the better students from the public schools, so that if charter schools continue to grow, then the city schools will be schools of last resort for kids who don't have strong parental involvement and don't have strong advocates.
Yeah, if you look at Newark, New Jersey, that's probably the best example of a high-profile case. That was the case where Mark Zuckerberg and big donors came in with $100 million, and the charter schools appeared to be doing okay, but then sort of the, for lack of a better term, left-behind schools in the public sector were struggling and have struggled, and it looks like Ross Baraka is essentially scrapping that program after just a few years.
Well, another concern that teachers have and other NYSET members is that the for-profit charter schools attempt to cut corners in ways that ultimately disadvantage kids and drive down the wages and benefits for professionals. And I think the data on that is pretty clear, too.
All right. Let's take the shortest break in radio. If you're waiting on the phone, you're next. Our Labor Day panel is going to take your questions as we talk about the state of our unions here on this Labor Day weekend. I'm Evan Dawson, and you're listening to member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, a titan of New Age music sits down with us. David Lanz talks about religion versus spirituality, living in Rochester, and how he manages to produce an album just about every year. Then we'll hear the personal story of a mom with her daughter's seizures and how a local camp has changed their lives. It's all coming up next hour on Connections.
This is WXXI AM Rochester. WXXI FM HD2 Rochester, go public online with WXXI.org.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. We have Sue in Fairport. Sue, thanks for calling. You're on with our Labor Day panel. Go ahead.
Hi. NYSET supports the carrying the Legislative Gazette and the Capital Connection and WXXI and other stations. Unfortunately, on WXXI, they're carried, as far as I'm concerned, in the middle of the night. I hope that changes, but it does limit the information you can get about Albany politics. My question is, the antidote to Mr. Cuomo, could it be a Democratic Senate? Thanks.
It's a fair question, and to Sue's point on the Senate, there's sort of a coalition now that is Democrats and Republicans and breakaway Democrats as a kind of a coalition that is heading up the Senate. There's a question on whether that could change. Anybody want to weigh in on how that may impact the state if that were to change?
I would just make the observation that the Senate has gone through some interesting changes over the past 4 or 5 years. Each time there's been a change, whether there was a group of independent senators who were influencing legislation, or for a time the Democrats had a majority but couldn't all get on the same page at the same time, there's not a lot of hope for these little clever fixes that come up. I don't really know if a Democratic Senate would yield anything better than what we have now.
Well, Democratic Senator Ted O'Brien is running for re-election. He was on this program a couple of days ago. We asked him about where he agrees and disagrees when it comes to some of these Let New York Work provisions. And I asked him that because one of Ted O'Brien's big new pushes is he has created a new ballot line, the Upstate New York Tax Relief ballot line, saying that his constituents tell him that tax relief is a huge issue. So I said, well, Unshackle Upstate agrees, and where do you agree and disagree, especially when it comes to things like WICs and scaffold? Here's Ted O'Brien.
Well, I think we're upstate, Unshackle Upstate and I have some commonality. Some common interests are really with respect to tax relief. But by the same time, we are very careful when we talk about undoing labor protections, which often are there for very important reasons. And so I think we want to be very cautious. So it's not the Unshackle Upstate agenda is not one I can embrace in its totality. But with respect to tax relief in particular, I think we see eye to eye on those kinds of issues.
And so perhaps along those lines, let's grab Bernard in Fairport, who wants to know about finding common ground. Go ahead, Bernard.
Well, my question is really one of, when I listen to this conversation, it seems to me that the unions are battling the business owners. Is this just interesting to make the conversation interesting, or is there really that much fight between the worker and the business owner? It seems to me that we need to somehow come together and compromise. It almost seems to me that you're not going to support the governor, but you're not going to say anything bad about the governor because you're afraid of the governor. So is the system that broken, or am I missing something? And thanks for the show.
Thank you, Bernard. Jim Bertolone, go ahead
and
start.
I think if the caller is familiar with the published comments of labor and the speech, that she'd find that there's no hesitancy to attack the governor on the part of labor. And we don't want to come across as anti-business. Any labor leader that I've known over the last four decades wants their business, their employer, to be successful. Otherwise, their members don't have secure employment and get raises. I think the interesting thing is that we're talking about some of the big players here, the billionaires, and even that doesn't apply to 100% to, say, a Warren Buffett. But I think there are interesting polls out there that a lot of small businesses and medium businesses are in favor of a $10.10 an hour minimum wage, because without people having money to spend, their sales are going down. It's very rare that you would have business on that side, but they are now seemingly solidly on that side. And again, I think it's organizing people, both union and non-union workers, that the only time workers historically have got economic judges either through legislation or in the workplace is when they make demands and they make them collectively.
Yeah. If I could just offer an observation on Jim's point there and see if our panel agrees. I think some of the opprobrium that labor feels in some ways for the business community has come when it wasn't that long ago when it would be totally unusual to see a CEO making 400 times what the average worker made, or 300 or 400 times. Maybe 300 or 400%, but not 300 or 400 times what that person was making. And I think in terms of when you have a free market, you've got capitalism, there are some who say, look, that is a function of capitalism, and others who say that is a good way to sow the seeds of resentment and trouble, and I think that's part of it. Now, interestingly, David K. Johnston, who's been on this program and writes about these issues often, and will be on this program, I hope, soon, talking about this very issue. Top earners, not necessarily CEOs, the top earners in terms of really the stratospheric numbers, have seen a slight decrease in what they're making, but it's still much different than it was 10, 20, 30, 50 years ago. Dave, is that a fair kind of analysis?
Well, it is. It would take to equal just one day's pay that the Koch brothers get, it takes the average worker 690 years. And it's people like Adelson's and the Koch brothers that are really financing and pushing the strong, strong anti-worker agendas, which are causing declining wages, benefit programs to be hurt or weakened, just lowering the entire standard of living. Some of the agenda seems to look like what would America think back. What did America look like before unions? You had 8, 10, 12-year-olds going to work in factories, being denied their education, being denied any dreams they could have for a real life in this world. They were in the factories because the families couldn't support themselves on just the fathers or the fathers and mothers' livings. As unions came about, got stronger, America became the powerhouse of the entire world. And as unions have been declining, we've seen a decline in our standards of living and the power of America throughout the world.
But Aaron Young, there are some people who would say, look, if a CEO makes 400 times what his workers make, it's because he has been successful and clever, and every one of us has that same opportunity.
I would disagree with that. I think that there are various models across the world, actually, of how people are given opportunities to not only personally have a decent life, but also professionally. There are models where the cost of education is not only more affordable, but in some cases, if your grades and your hard work earn you that for secondary education, it's handed to you. Now, do people make what some other people here make in some of these other areas? No. But you know what? They don't have to worry about health care. They don't have to worry about whether or not they're going to be able to get the education that their hard work, what they deserve due to their hard work. That's a model that to me is ideal for a country, for the rest of the world. However, this is the way things are here right now. This is what we are trying to educate the community on. Labor needs to put that message out, outside of labor, that we are not doing this because we're defending our union members. We're doing this because we are defending workers in general. And I want to make that very, very clear. We are not in a position right now where that is conducive to not only improving after the recession, and I know it's argued back and forth whether we are or we aren't. I would say we're not. A CEO making 400 times what a worker does, if you look at the graph over the course of the last 30 years, and what people were able to bring in, what the cost of living was, and what their standard of life is compared to what it is today, you see a lot more people having to rely on credit, a lot more people that have to borrow in order to send their children to a secondary education institute of their choice. This isn't what the American dream is. I think that they're having to borrow in order to achieve that more and more. That's what led to the bank crisis, and that's what we're here to blow the whistle on.
All right, let's grab Pete. Pete, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Evan, I hope before these guests leave today, you schedule 1 hour with each of them so that we can do more than superficially discuss the issues.
Well, hold on, Pete. That's a good point. I mean, I was just talking to Tom Gillette about the fact that we could talk about tenure in a minute and a half, or we could spend a whole hour on it. We're going to spend a whole hour on it. We're going to be doing that. Yes.
That's why it's important that the voice of labor, the voice of the members of our community, our neighbors, our friends, and our family members, their voice is heard. Unions bring democracy to the workplace. And I would suggest the website, democracyatwork.info. Now, to Mr. Young, I would ask you, I hope you have a pen and paper ready, because I'm going to suggest that you take a look at Mark Jacobson, a civil and environmental engineer out of Stanford University, produced a study, How to Power the World Without Fossil Fuels and Do It by 2030, which was the cover story on Scientific American back in 2009. Last April, he repeated his assertion that we could power the world without fossil fuels and do it by 2030. Plus, he added that they studied New York State and came to the same conclusion. We could do completely renewable by 2030. I am totally against fracking. I object fundamentally on fracking. Why? Because we need to make this transition. The planet, we are on a road to extinction. We could create millions of jobs producing the technology, the products that are going to provide the solar, wind, geothermal, wave, and whatever other renewable energy sources we could refine. But we have to get on the same page.
All right, Pete, let me let Dave respond. Thank you for that. Thanks for the call, Pete. You were scribbling some notes there.
Oh, yeah. I'm taking it's an excellent statement and question. I know the building trades are on the same page. What we're trying to do is figure out how do we make these transitions without destroying hundreds of thousands or millions of lives in the process. We all know that global warming it's real. It's here. It's not coming. It's here. It's a problem. We've invested, I know just the IBEW, of which I'm the business manager of, has invested millions and millions of dollars in training for wind energy, solar energy. So what we're trying to do is put together and support policies and programs that have that very intelligent transition that elevates everybody and doesn't destroy a lot of people, families, and lives.
All right, and to Pete's point, he's right. I mean, a lot of these issues need their own hour, and we're going to do that. I mean, Tom Gillette and I were talking about the fact that tenure is going to need its own hour, and I hope in a few weeks we'll come back and talk about it. But a brief point as we talk about Labor Day, that's a common complaint some people have, or it's a common question they have about tenure. They may not realize, as you've pointed out, there have been some changes in recent years.
Actually, there have been significant changes. That section of education law was modified in 2008, again in 2010, and again in 2012. And the effect of these changes was to reduce the costs of the process and reduce the time. I think very, very often the protections of tenure are exaggerated in the newspaper or in public reporting. And if people really understood both that section of the law and the data behind it, they might have a different view.
Can you fire a ostensibly bad teacher without years of litigation and hundreds of thousands of dollars of bills?
Yes. Actually, the time frame now since 2012 has been approximately 5 months to go through a 30-20A process.
Okay. And, Pete, you're right. We're going to take that on in a totally different day with more time and depth. Just as David Gottfried and others on Twitter who are asking about Scaffold or have their own complaints or questions about that, Scaffold and Wix is going to get its own hour. I think we should talk pension on a separate day. But let's start to kind of wind down here. Let me take one more call, and then we'll get some final thoughts as we head into Labor Day weekend. This is Eric in the city of Rochester. Eric, thanks for calling Connections.
Sure. So I was wondering if someone could quickly comment on the recent supermarket chain in the Boston area that had a work stoppage, and the demand revolved around bringing back the CEO who had been fired. There was a family dispute, and the CEO that they wanted back just came back. But the cost was millions of dollars incurred during the stoppage when things really came to a halt. So what's the takeaway narrative from that? Is that an example of what workers can achieve when they show solidarity, or is it that sometimes you can shoot yourself in the foot when you think you're doing something?
Thanks for the call, Eric. Jim Bertolin.
I think it goes back to what I said a little earlier about union officials wanting their employers to do good. This is the caller brought up a great story. This is actually a non-union place, and they went on strike and they started a boycott because of a family takeover where they got rid of a CEO who paid decent wages, who cared about the employees, actually took input and suggestions from employees to make the business better, and they won. And Arthur T., now is going to buy out his cousin, Arthur S., and they're going back to work. And this is a billionaire that these people went on strike for because they were proud to work. They made that business successful. They were treated fairly. And I think this shows that the claims from people like the Koch brothers and Karl Rove that there's a class war is a bunch of baloney, that the only class war has come from billionaires and people. And I think it also goes to Unshackles talking about taxes. We had a fair share tax here that was made worse. When you look at taxes that aren't progressive, and are regressive, like property and school taxes are regressive, as opposed to a progressive tax. The wealthiest 10% of New Yorkers pay half as a percentage of income than the working poor and the middle class when you add up all New York's taxes. So we're in favor of tax relief, too, but not for the top. They're doing all right.
All right, one more quick question. David on Twitter asks, would the president of the Rochester Building and Construction Trades support fracking in New York State if we mandated all fracking be prevailing wage?
All right, now you're asking a question between my personal feelings and my job representing the building and construction trades.
And you've got to do it in about 14 seconds, Dave.
Okay. The building and construction trades official position would be yes.
You'd support it.
The building and construction trades official position would be yes.
Would support fracking if it were prevailing
wage. Would support, yes. And if the safety precautions were in there and we took the lessons that were learned in Pennsylvania and applied them.
But you personally... Doesn't sound like it.
Sounds like we're out of time.
It does sound like we're out of time. How about that? There's so much to talk about, though, and I want to thank our panel for coming in as they get ready to celebrate Labor Day. Tom Gillette, great to see you.
Same here.
Jim Bertolone, thank you for being here, sir.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
Dave Young, thank you.
Thank you.
Aaron Young from Rochester and Genesee Valley Labor Federation, thank you.
Thank you, and happy Labor Day.
And to you all as well, and to our listeners, have a great weekend. Much more to come next hour here on Member Supported Public Radio.